This podcast is recorded at the University of Sydney's Camperdown campus on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. They've been discovering and sharing knowledge here for tens of thousands of years. I pay my respects to elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. When Alistair Campbell was just 28, he got a dream promotion. He was news editor at a leading British tabloid. High pressure, high stress, he loved it. And he was at the absolute top of his game. He was covering the biggest stories in the UK. But then, suddenly, he found himself in the middle of a park in Scotland having a psychotic breakdown. He thought it was the end of his career. He thought it was the end of his marriage.
Down. I was hearing voices. I was seeing things that weren't there.
But then Alistair Campbell went on to become a formidable presence in UK politics. Right-hand man to Tony Blair as press secretary, he was a key player at important moments in 20th century history. The end of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the death of Diana, and the Iraq War.
Deep down, I wish it had never happened. But at the same time, I can still defend the decisions that Tony Blair made at the time.
But all the while, behind the scenes, he struggled with depression.
I feel very, very sad, but it's worse than sad. It's like, I know I'm alive, but I feel dead.
Alistair's now a mental health advocate, an author, and a co-host of the hugely successful podcast, The Rest is Politics. I'm Mark Scott, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Sydney, and this is The Solutionists. Alistair, welcome. Take me back to the 1980s. You were working at the Mirror newspaper and then at the Today newspaper, climbing the ranks. Reflect on those times. What was it like to be a journo in that tabloid era?
Well, I loved it, actually. I think the great thing about being a journalist in any era is that your job is really just to kind of ask people questions and have conversations. And I used to think there was a story in anybody, and there was.
Yeah.
It was pretty wild. It was actually quite a friendly place, even though there was a lot of backstabbing in terms of between newspapers. Within the newspaper, there was a sense of a team. Yeah. But it was kind of defining for me because I, as you say, I was a bit of a high flyer, and then I suddenly crashed and burned, and I thought it was all over. But I think one of the things I've always had is a sense of curiosity, and I think that's what journalism is about, really. You've got to be curious about the world.
We've referenced 1986, the year you were on the trail of Neil Kinnock, the UK Labour leader. You're in a high-pressure job and it all boils over. Tell us what happened.
Well, the day started in a hotel room where I'd gone to the hotel because Fiona, my partner, and I, we'd fallen out. I'd been drinking all day and I ended up in the hotel, emptying the minibar, and I woke up kind of in my own vomit, basically. But I had to get to Scotland. Mm-hmm. Because Neil Kinnock was speaking at the Scottish Labour Party conference. So I got to Heathrow, bought a new suit, bought a new shirt, bought a new tie, went to the gents and sort of washed myself and got sorted out. And then just as the day wore on, I felt weirder and weirder and weirder, really wired. I think the moment when I knew it was going really a bit crazy, I hired a car and I was driving to this place and I got in this roundabout and I couldn't get off the roundabout. Mm. I was going around hundreds of times and I just couldn't turn off the roundabout. Eventually I did. I went to this place. I dumped the car. I went, if you're going to have a breakdown, try not to have it in a top secret secure naval dockyard, right? But I went into this naval base and I went through the entrance and I said, listen, that's my car out there. I can't drive it anymore. Here's the keys. Here's the number. I think there was some kind of weird espionage operation, right? Anyway, so I just dumped the car. I then got a taxi. I'd lost Neil Kinnock by now. He'd moved on. So I'm now panicking. And then I start to see things and I'm not quite sure what's real, what's not. And then by the end of the day, I was having a full-blown psychotic breakdown. I was hearing voices. I was seeing things that weren't there. Some of them were there, but you couldn't work out what was real and what wasn't. And eventually I got arrested. I was emptying my pockets. I was emptying this bag that I had. I think I was about to take my clothes off. And these two policemen, plain clothes, who were special branch looking after Neil, They came up and said, listen, are you all right? And I said, I don't think I am, you know. And they took me away.
Mm.
I look back now as it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Why is that?
Because I sorted myself out afterwards. I rebuilt myself. I did think my life was over. I thought, I'm finished in my career. I thought, Fiona's going to leave me. In fact, the next day, she and her dad flew up, and it was obvious she wasn't going to leave me. So I kind of understood that I couldn't blow that again. I stopped drinking. I didn't touch alcohol for the next 13 years. And I rebuilt myself. And I just think everything I've done since then, all the stuff that's been difficult, like, you know, working in government, running campaigns, taking a lot of crap from the media, all that stuff, I don't think I could have done it without that experience. Because it gave me this yardstick. It didn't matter to me that people were saying all sorts of stuff, because I thought, listen, I've had worse than this.
And is coming back from that the hardest thing you've ever had to do?
I don't know about that. Funny enough, I think that, as you asked the question, I think the hardest thing I had to do was many years later when I saw my son going through something very similar.
Mm.
Because I felt with that even though I'd been through a similar experience, I just felt I wasn't handling it well. So that was hard. Watching your son kind of descend into alcoholism was really hard. He's 11 years dry now, so we kind of got through it, but that was hard. And then I think I didn't find it hard at the time because I had this, look, I know Australians love their cricket. I had this thing where I was counting every day as a run.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, I was climbing into bed and saying, oh, it's another, he gets another run there. He's now on 6,418. Yeah. I was literally counting the days. And it was just like once I'd made the switch in my mind, I'm going to sort myself out. I didn't find it that difficult. I didn't find stopping drinking as difficult as I thought I would. A lot of people find that really hard. And then the next thing that happened was that essentially I realized that the alcohol and the work were probably both addictions that I was using to cover up the reasons for the addictions, which was the depression. And I didn't really get that fixed until after I left Downing Street, to be honest, because I'd convinced myself I'd done all the hard yards by stopping drinking, and that was me fixed. But it wasn't.
There's more work to be done.
Yeah.
Let's talk about getting into politics, because, you know, once you stopped drinking, your career flourished again. You ended up political editor of a newspaper, and then you made the decision to move into politics. You know, I've heard many journalists talk about moving to the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
How tough a decision was that to you to leave journalism to join politics in 1994?
Leaving journalism wasn't that tough because, I mean, look, if I hadn't had the offer, if Tony Blair hadn't said to me I'd want to come work with me, I probably would have carried on being a journalist. But I was getting a bit tired of journalism. Too much of the stuff I was doing was coming around again.
You'd seen it all before. Yeah.
Well, it just felt quite repetitive. And I think also I was conscious of the fact that the media landscape was changing, I think, for the worse. This whole kind of, you know, the Murdochization of our press. I mean, that had already happened, but I think once you got into television as well, I think our media became a pretty bad place. And so I didn't find it that hard, but actually I said no for a month. Mm. Tony Blair asked me repeatedly, I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And the main reason I said no was partly because of the breakdown. I thought, well, you know, I've cracked up before and this is going to be way worse pressure than being a journalist. But also Fiona, my partner, my parents, Neil Kinnock, all saying, don't do it, don't do it. But something in me, I sort of knew I would do it when he asked me, but I took a long time to say yes.
Dance around to finally saying yes.
Yeah.
You know, you speak very openly about your breakdown. You talk about, you know, being worried would things be triggered again. Was the fact that you'd had that experience, and that experience really in kind of quite a public way, was that an issue in taking a job that led you to Downing Street? Were you as open about it?
I was, there? Yeah. And actually, I think it could have been an issue. But I remember when Tony, we were on holiday in France, and I said to Tony, okay, I'm going to think about it over a holiday. Just don't pester me. I'm going to think about it. So we went off on holiday, as it happens with the Kinnocks. I mean, it's amazing how the same people weave in and out of your life. And so we're on holiday in France, and I get a phone call from Tony saying, oh, we're only 5 hours away. We'll pop in tomorrow.
We're popping down.
Yeah, we're going to pop down and see you. And of course, he came to try and talk me into doing the job, which I did. And I said, Tony, I want to go through everything that I've done in my past, that's happened to me in my past, that could become a problem. Okay. So I went through all sorts of stuff. The fact that I'd written pornography, the fact that I used to get involved in fights at university and nearly got kicked out, all sorts of stuff. And then the breakdown. And I told him in detail. I said, look, I know you
know. Were you layering them one on another? Well, if that doesn't throw you, let me.
Yeah, here's another one. Here's another one. And I'm thinking several things. The main thing I'm thinking is there enough kind of stuff in here that the media decide to get into it and he thinks, oh, this is just too tricky. So I just laid it all out on the line. And I told him about the breakdown and I was describing it in detail. And I remember there was this bit where I was saying to him, so at one point, my brain's exploding. I've got this inside my head feels like a glass sort of building that's shattering. And I'm covering my face with my hands because I can't work out why there's no blood because inside there's all this glass shattering. And then suddenly Elvis Presley starts singing and there's a bit of ABBA and then Fiona starts shouting at me and then there's an argument going on in the office and he was looking at me like he really did look like quite worried. But then he said, well, that's all right. I'm not bothered if you're not bothered. And I said, what if I'm bothered? He said, I'm still not bothered. Mm. So and I always say when I'm talking about this, leadership in employment is so important.
Yeah.
You know, because he could easily have thought, oh, this is a bit tricky.
I've often thought when it comes to recruitment that it's really just a great act of trust, isn't it? You're really trusting that. Why do you think he trusted you when you lay all those stories in front of him?
I think because he knew me quite well and he thought what I've seen in this guy, I think I need it. Mm. And he said, in fact, in that time in France, he said, look, you know, this is going to be really tough and I've got loads of good people who are very good at tactics. He said, but I think you've got a very strategic mind and that's what I need. I need people with strategic minds. But I think also there is a skill, I think, in recruitment and in leadership, which is about being able genuinely to assess people's character. When there might be a lot of noise around them and other people might have judgment. I think Tony did have a very good, I mean, the team that we built was pretty impressive. And I think he had a really good sense of what people's qualities were and how enduring they could be.
And so you work with him, he wins government. How do you find the pressure that you're worried about, you know, when you're working in the Prime Minister's office in such a 24/7 world?
I never felt I was cracking up. I did feel stress. I think I learned the difference between pressure and stress. I like pressure. I like being under pressure, but I don't like stress. I don't like feeling when you feel I'm not in control here. But pressure, I like. And I think the other thing is you have to have the ability to, I'm not good at switching off, but I did have the ability to, you know, if I'm focusing on half a dozen things at once, I was able to focus on them one at a time. So that I wasn't kind of just having this chaos.
A sequential focusing on the issue of the moment.
Absolutely. So, and in a funny sort of way, the job helped with that because, I mean, I was his spokesman and press secretary and director of strategy. And I guess because the spokesman bit meant contact with the media, I think they thought was the most important part of my job. It wasn't really. I used that part of the job to strategize more. So every morning when I did a briefing with the media, I had to be on top of absolutely everything. Anything that I might get asked about, I had to be on top of it. In getting on top of it, I was kind of working out, I hope, where real problems were and real challenges were and where we had to sort of make the next steps. That was what I was trying to do.
You kept a diary, which you've published. Mm-hmm. I think you look at that diary, you think there are a lot of days you didn't seem too thrilled with the world.
No, that's true.
So reflect back on it now. Was it a great time? Was it worth it for you? Were you happy doing it?
Oh, it's really interesting you say that because if you'd have said to me at the time, I'd have said, oh, loving it, round peg in a round hole. This is what I was made for. Mm. But then when I read the diaries back, when I transcribed the diaries, I couldn't believe how often I was like clearly depressed. Started off, you know, woke up, felt shit, went to bed, felt shit. You know, it was like, and then through the day, this was awful, that was awful. Oh God, why did he do that? Why did she do that? Why did I do that? So looking back, I'm very, very, very happy that I did it. But I recognize I probably wasn't very happy a lot of the time doing it. And I think the other thing that happens in those jobs is you absorb so much of other people's pressure. And then I think the thing I really do regret, I think you then pile it on to the other people. Particularly your family, probably.
Family in the office too?
A little bit, but I had a good, really good team in the office. I think I did pile it onto them, but but in a way that they saw that as part of their job as well.
I want to move on to the political landscape more broadly now, but just back to two issues that you had to deal with that I think generated so much attention at the time. You know, one was the you being called in to help out the royal family mm-hmm. at the time of the death of Diana. How did you engage at that point to help them deal with that crisis and the rigidity of the image that the world was watching that they were projecting?
Look, I was in bed in London. Tony was in bed in Sedgefield. In fact, you know, famously, they had to get a copper to go and wake him up because he didn't have a phone on, he didn't have an alarm clock. And, you know, my phone rang, I can't remember, middle of the night. In fact, the first I heard of it was a pager message in the days of pagers. So my pager went off and it said car crash in Paris, Dodi dead, Diana seriously injured. This is not a joke.
Almost immediately after the announcement of her death, there were demonstrations of grief by the princess's admirers in Britain. Some wept openly, others stood in silence. Many left the pavement strewn with flowers and with tributes.
But in terms of helping them, what happened was when the body was flown back the next day, or that day, later that day, because it was the early hours by then, when the body was flown back, they, the palace, said that Tony as Prime Minister should go, and Charles was there and other members of the royal household were there. I think other ministers were there, and I actually went separately, but obviously it was, you know, I was by then talking to Tony the whole time about how we're handling this and how we're handling that. And he had a conversation with Lord Airlie, who was the head of the royal household, and they both called me over, and Airlie said, look, we've got every funeral planned for the royals. You know, if the Queen died tomorrow, we know what to do. If Charles dies, if, you know, but Diana is not a royal anymore, so we're going to need help on this.
Buckingham Palace has not yet said when or where the funeral will take place or where the princess will be buried.
And now they know, because they knew me when I was a journalist, and I mean, I'm not the biggest monarchist.
Not the biggest fan. Yeah.
No. And yet, so there were for the next few days. I was in the palace as much as I was in Number 10. And actually, it was really good. The engagement was really good. We were very sensitive to their issues. Not sure if they were quite as sensitive to our issues, because in their world it didn't matter as much. We were conscious of the fact that the right-wing media in particular was gagging to say Tony Blair's trying to take this whole thing over. So it was quite a tricky kind of balancing act. But it was it was an incredible week. And the end of it, you know this in funerals in our own lives, that sometimes you have a death and there's all sorts of awful, terrible drama, and then the funeral brings a kind of closure. And it really felt like that. But on this massive
global scale,
yeah.
A lot of the pressure on the Blair government began to unravel with the Iraq War, and you were involved in putting together a document that made the case for the weapons of mass destruction. But then the Blair government was accused of exaggerating the evidence, and the BBC reported that the weapons inspector, David Kelly, said the report had been sexed up, and within a week, David Kelly took his own life. You've reflected in your podcast, looking back on that time. How do you reflect back on your decision-making and the issues you were dealing with?
It's interesting because even Fiona, my partner, she said after she listened, she said, God, I've never ever heard you talk about Iraq like that before. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, I just haven't. I felt I was saying things that I've said 1,000 times. But I think what was happening was I was being more reflective.
The British government published its own dossier saying that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction that could be ready in 45 minutes.
The intelligence picture they paint is one accumulated over the last 4 years. It is extensive, detailed, and authoritative.
The government later admitted that intelligence was faulty and the 45-minute claim was wrong.
I mean, look, deep down, I wish it had never happened. But at the same time, I can still defend the decisions that Tony Blair made at the time. And I do still get very, very angry that, you know, the whole Tony Blair thing, the fact that I get labelled as having sort of manipulated intelligence when I know I didn't, the fact that there's not a single day, not literally not a single day, in fact, there's not a single tweet I do that somebody in reply doesn't post a picture of David Kelly or doesn't call me a war criminal or whatever it might be. And again, I go back to the thing about the resilience that you build through something like having had a breakdown. That sort of helps you get through it. But I found the whole, it was a horrible, horrible, horrible period, no doubt about that. And, you know, I said in my diaries on the day that David Kelly's body was found, I phoned Tony. I said, listen, I want out. I can't do this anymore. I can't do it. And Tony talked me into staying for a bit. I was already trying to leave anyway because I was kind of slightly at the end of my tether. So I reflect it on the policy. I reflect in this way. I basically think that I still support the decision based upon what Tony Blair was being told, and also based upon the fact that we knew that Saddam had used chemical and biological weapons in the past, and also based on the fact that Tony Blair did see the closeness of our relationship with the United States as being a fundamental national strategic interest. But I can also see, one, why people thought it was the wrong decision, and I can also see why people look at it in retrospect with hindsight and think you could have handled that a lot better than you did.
Since the Iraq War, since the global financial crisis, we've just seen this trust in government continue to erode. What's gone wrong with politics, and why is this declining trust such a global phenomenon?
I think the crash was the big thing. And the reason that I think that is because I think that's what opened the door to populists who've been around for quite a while, presenting themselves as the, you know, the friends of the people against the elite. But what happened with the crash is that essentially it confirmed this idea that the kind of the bankers and the politicians are completely screwed up and created this terrible crisis. The bankers didn't pay a price and the people did. And that allowed the populist politicians who have got no interest in providing solutions to come along and exploit that problem. I also think, to be absolutely honest, I know your background in media, my background in media, I think the way that the media has developed in recent decades, the sort of constant denigration of public life, the constant degradation of politics, this, and also politicians not doing a very good job at defending themselves as a breed. So that, you know, both in your country and in mine, most of what you see as politics is politician A puts forward a plan, politician B from the other side says it's the most stupid idea there's ever been, and vice versa. So I think it's a combination of the spread of, you see, populism wouldn't spread unless there was a fertile ground for it to spread. And what the populists have also then done, they've used the other, I talk about the three Ps, populism, polarization, and post-truth. I think the three go together very, very well. Social media has flared up the polarization quite well. And post-truth has been an incredible phenomenon for me because, you know, like I said earlier, we got accused of lying. I know we didn't lie. But now we have politicians who lie and get away with it.
Yeah.
And I think that is a relatively new phenomenon. But what it says, it also says something about the public that they hate it on one level, but they don't mind it on the other.
They soak it up, really.
Yeah. And that's what's got us in this absolutely incredible situation where Trump, who's a total liar, absolute charlatan, and could come back.
Mm.
Incredible.
Do you see a pathway for politicians in this environment, with a public that's kind of so open to the three Ps you articulated, yeah, is there a pathway for politicians to have a more positive style of leadership?
I think there is, because I actually think that I wrote a book called Winners about 9 years ago now, and it was about what politics could learn from business and sport and vice versa. And one of the best quotes in it was from Arsene Wenger, the manager of Arsenal, and he said this thing, which I thought was really wise. He said, we've gone from a vertical world to a horizontal world. In the vertical world, leaders sat at the top, made decisions, and the decisions worked their way down through the system. In the horizontal world, the leader is surrounded by noise created by others all the time. And the response has been to be ever more tactical, because you deal with this bit of noise, that bit of noise. And he said the response should be to be ever more strategic. And I think the problem with a lot of our politicians today is that they're just very, very tactical. Take Angela Merkel in Germany. Okay, her reputation has been marked down in recent years because of the Putin, Ukraine, dependence on Russian oil, etc. But if you look at her career as chancellor, winning four terms, she wasn't one of these new leaders. She was leading with detail and respect and dignity and all the things that we say we want from leaders. I also think Macron in France, although, you know, he's in a bit of trouble at the moment and not as popular as he was, but, you know, he kind of came out of nothing with a very positive vision. So it doesn't have to be that the populists win every time. You know, we've just had Donald Tusk in Poland, who, you know, I would argue here with I think Morrison was a bit of a 3P leader. Not as bad as Johnson, but, you know, the same breed. And he's gone, beaten by something else. Now, so I think politicians are way, way too defensive about themselves, about what they do. I think sometimes in politics, actually saying to people, look, politicians can't do everything. Governments can't do everything. And what's happened is the model, the old model, essentially, is the politician stands up and says, vote for me and I'll give you everything you want. And then it doesn't happen. So you create disillusion. I think the public are ready for politicians who stand up and say, vote for me and I'll give you leadership. Vote for me and I'll focus on priorities. Vote for me and I'll have a plan to address this, 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 and this. But I can't give you everything. You know, I just think I think that old model is I think it's gone. And yet, maybe I'm wrong because, you know, they're all hanging on to the old model. And then meanwhile, you have these, you know, I do think there's got to be a comeuppance for the liars. I really do. But it needs confidence. It needs a more positive message than a lot of the progressive politicians are giving out. But then you look at somebody like America and you think, well, Joe Biden's done a pretty good job. He gets no credit. He gets very little credit for it. And that effing monster's still hanging around like a bad smell could get back in.
Are you encouraged by the success of your podcast, The Rest is Politics, that there is a market and interest in intelligent discourse and divergent views coming together?
And I think it is about this thing. We have this motto, disagree agreeably. So we do disagree about stuff, but we try to do it agreeably. We've only had one bad fallout. We have guests on that we try and treat with respect, even though we don't agree with them always. And I think there's something strange happening. I think within the media landscape, the center's being hollowed out. And so you've got these two very different new forms that have emerged. One is kind of people getting all their news from TikTok or just scrolling on Twitter, which is kind of, you know, just cheap thrill, one story, next story, next story, next story, next story. And then the other is sitting down and listening to something where people try and do things in real depth. And I am encouraged by the fact that, I'll tell you, when we filled out the Albert Hall, we sold the Albert Hall in 9 minutes. And we did some data on the people there, and a third were under 30, which I thought was great. I was in this school the other day somewhere in southern England, and this girl said, and her friends laughed when she asked the question, but I felt really sad. She said, has politics always been this bad? And I said, how old are you? And she said, I think she said 13 or 14. And her first political memory was Boris Johnson. Well, if all you've seen is Boris Johnson, Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, for you, politics has always been this bad. So actually trying to explain to her, there have been some really good prime ministers down the years, there have been some great ministers, there have been some amazing change, and there still can be. But it's harder in this environment. I kind of remain optimistic. I think, look, to be honest, we either go up or we go right under. And I kind of feel we'll go up at some point.
You have hope.
I do, yeah. And I'll tell you where I get the hope is actually in going to schools. I think a lot of kids have worked this out. They know that what's happening isn't working.
Are you worried about the juxtaposition of a political environment that can be very dispiriting and a global environment, climate, everything else that can be so bleak and pessimistic, and mental health issues in society? And so what's the message of hope for young people?
They do have the capacity to make the change. And I can see why a lot of the time they feel that they don't. But look, I write in the book a lot about individual people, a lot of them young women, Greta Thunberg being an obvious one. But also, for example, I write a chapter about a woman called Gina Martin, dealing with this thing about no point getting involved because one person can't make a difference. So what happened, I don't know if you know this story, but she was at a festival. And she noticed that these two guys were filming her up her skirt. The police there, because it was a big sort of big crowd festival, she said, excuse me, those two guys are following me around, filming up my skirt. didn't ever have this before. Phoned in, and the guy came back and said, look, I'm really sorry about this. But there's no law against it. Hmm. She said, right, well, within a year, there was a law against it.
Yeah.
And she drove that by herself. And when you go through the process of how she did it, I explain to people, it's really hard to make change, but you can do it. Mm. So I think there'll come a point where either democracy explodes and it goes, and I genuinely do worry if Trump comes back, that could happen, or actually this we'll look back at this as a wave of a sort of populist, trivializing, polarizing wave where we were dragged down and then people realized that and then they moved into a different direction. It won't be going back to anything, it'll be going to something different. And I really think that has to be about young people getting their voice and doing it in a way that isn't just about shouting at politicians and isn't just about, you know, it's about them actually having ideas about how you can make change. Mm.
In your advocacy for, you know, funding and programs around mental health, you've spoken so honestly about your own experiences. Has that been a deliberate decision that that's what you feel you want to do, that's what you feel you have a responsibility to do? And are there any times where you think, I just don't want to talk about this anymore?
No, I've never, ever, ever. I like talking about mental health. My one worry is I think both here in Australia and in the UK, I think we've had a lot of success on the awareness front. But one of the problems with that is we've made more people aware, but then they've all thought, oh yeah, well, I feel a bit ill, I'll go and see a doctor, and they find there's no services there. We've now got to do the same on services, and we've got to do the same on prevention as well. But no, I feel, I've always felt very, very comfortable about it. Partly it goes back to the point I made about what the atmosphere was like in the Daily Mirror when I went back after my breakdown. People were really, really supportive, and they helped me realize, actually, there's no problem about being open with this. It's fine. And then the other thing is, you know, I had my own issues, but I also had a brother, Donald, who had schizophrenia, and he's the real reason I campaign on this. Because, so my dad was 82 when he died, and Donald was 62 when he died. The average lifespan of somebody who spends an adult life on antipsychotic medication is 20 years lower than you and I. And that's just so wrong. So I think that, you know, whether it's about awareness, whether it's a services, but that's a research question. We haven't really changed the medications on mental illness for a long, long time.
Yeah, so it strikes me that when you look at the sophistication and the precision of, say, cancer medications now and personalized medicine, the treatment of mental health, as far as medication is concerned, just seems a century behind.
Well, look at what happened with COVID. Mm. I mean, you know, when the world had to, it did.
Yeah.
And we've got a vaccine. Similarly, when we had to, I don't know if you had the same here, but in the UK, when COVID happened, suddenly, because people were getting worried that these poor people living on the streets might actually have COVID and give it to me walking by them, we found places for them to live.
Yeah. So why can't mental health get higher up the government priority list, medical research funding? Why is it still such a battle?
Because, two reasons I'd say. One is because the other pressures are so monumental. But secondly, I think the getting rid of stigma and taboo, it takes time. I think we're getting there. I also think we haven't won the argument that over time, this is a money saver as well as a lifesaver. I think that, well, if Labour get in, I'm really pleased that one of the things they're going to do, they're going to put these mental health hubs into schools. I think if we could just think about everyone, not everyone's mentally ill, but everyone has mental health. And just as we try and teach our kids to look after their physical health by running around and eating well and all that, we've got to do the same for mental health. But also, to be honest, it does take leadership. You do need political leaders who are going to say, this matters, this is a priority. And so it will only happen when they say, this mental health stuff is more important than other things. But I think it is, because ultimately, you know, the stats on suicide in Australia, it's the same in the UK. They're horrific. They're right at the top. Mm. If that was any other, if you deleted suicide and put any other illness that was having that effect on people's lives and cost, and so it'd get fixed.
So do you think there's still a taboo issue there? What is it around mental illness, mental health.
People are scared.
Scared of what?
Well, that's where taboo comes from. You have a taboo when you have a fear. So, like, when I was a kid, and you remember this, we didn't call cancer, we called it the big C. Mm. Why did we call it the big C? Because we didn't want to call it what it was. Why didn't we want to call it what it was? Because it was scary. I remember my mum once sitting us down at the kitchen table and saying that one of our neighbours said, Mr. Whittaker, he's got cancer. You mustn't tell anybody. Now, if you think about, you mentioned earlier about cancer treatments and cures that are sort of now around. If cancer had always stayed as the big C, you wouldn't have had the success that you'd have. So I think we're in the kind of big C phase still. So it's fear. I think a lot of that fear is in employment. I think people are really scared in the workplace of being open. They think it'll be held against them, including, by the way, in the healthcare systems, which is where you think it shouldn't be like that. But I know people in the healthcare systems who say, I wouldn't dream of telling my boss. But we've got to get rid of that. You know, if somebody comes to you, and I'm now a bit of a sort of positive discriminator. If I see two identical sort of, you know, CVs and, you know, same degree, same gap year, same this, same that, same interest, but one of them has got a few months that have gone missing and maybe they were in a treatment center or maybe they're in prison, I'm going to go for that one. Because I just think, you know, one, what do we want out of people? We want honesty. And we want resilience.
Resilience. So what does it feel like when you're experiencing depression?
I think everybody's different. With me, it's like a cloud, but it's sort of, and it comes in, and I can feel it coming in, and then it gets into me, and it sort of fills my veins, and my legs feel like lead. And I feel sad. I feel very, very sad, but it's worse than sad. It's like I know I'm alive, I'm breathing, I can see things, I can eat, I can drink, I can walk, but I feel dead. It's like feeling dead, but you're living. When it's bad, it's truly horrible. And the thing is that you feel like, even though you know you've been through it before, when it strikes like that, you think, oh, this is it. This is the last, this is it forever now. This one is going to be. And that's why I understand why people get driven to suicide when you have that, it's such an intense feeling. I have actually been able now to build on the sense of, oh, I've been through this before. Mm. You know, it's going to end. I'll get through this.
You're working incredibly hard. You're cranking out, you know, more than a book a year, big podcasts, you know, speaking engagements around the world. How do you manage the busyness and staying on top?
Well, I don't always manage it very well, is the truth. Partly, I don't know really, partly by keeping fit. Physical exercise, I think, is really important. I'm obsessed with sleep. The depressions that I get come on. They can come on quite suddenly, but I'm kind of aware of them coming on. But then I've also got to be very careful when I've never been diagnosed with bipolar, but I get very manic at times. Mm. And I'm incredibly creative and I've got unbelievable energy, but I've really got to watch that as well.
Do you believe you haven't been diagnosed because you haven't pursued it? Or is that a diagnosis you have in your own
head
about?
I think I've been diagnosed, yeah. and I've got depression. I get depression. Yeah. But the psychiatrist, I've saw a psychiatrist for a long time, and he said, I don't think you're bipolar, but you get very bad depression. And so he would argue that other people might define as my manic is actually me most of the time.
Right.
And that's about energy.
Yeah.
But I had this wonderful experience in Canada. I did a TV documentary and then a book about my depression. But the idea from the BBC, you like this because I know you're big in telly. And so the BBC came and said, you know, we want you to do a documentary on depression. We want you to travel around the world, go wherever you want, talk to different people about how they deal with their depression, doctors, scientists, researchers, etc. And then our dream, you know, is that you explore it and then, hey, presto, your depression's gone. And the final scene is I'm walking into the sunset and I throw my antidepressants over my shoulder, etc. Anyway, that didn't happen. What did happen is that I met a woman in Canada who is a geneticist. And after we stopped filming, she said, how do you deal with your depression then? Said to me. And I said, oh, well, I see a psychiatrist and I take medication. Oh, she said, because I get, and she, I'm normally good at spotting if people who've got depression. Didn't read it with her at all. She said, oh, that's interesting, because I get really bad depression. Oh, said he, surprised. I said, how do you deal with it? And she said, I've got a jam jar. So she basically said, she said, look, there's your jam jar. I'll use the bottle because it's got less water in it. There's a jam jar, and down in the bottom, that's your genes.
Yeah.
Okay? And in the jam jar, that's sediment. Nothing you can do about it. Nothing you can do about your genes. The rest of the jam jar is your life, and it fills up with good experiences and bad experiences. And normally we cope. Most of the time, normally we cope. But then whenever it gets out of control, the jam jar explodes, and that's when we're ill. And she said, we spend all our time trying to fix this stuff down here. But you can't undo it. What you can do is grow the jam jar so you can put more of life into it. And I didn't really know what she was talking about, but then it clicked a few days later. And I now use the jam jar. And what it is that I use it as a sort of working tool. I travel with it. And if I'm starting to feel
a physical jam jar.
Yeah, it's a jam jar.
Yeah.
And if I'm starting to feel depressed, I look at it. And I see the sediment, and there's the life, and then I build on it all the things that I know have helped me. So the first thing is FFF, Fiona, family, friends, okay? Next one is meaningful activity, both work to make a living, but work to change the world. Then my fundamentals, which are sleep, diet, exercise. Then the stuff that matters to me, Burnley Football Club, bagpipe music, my dog, my bike. Then the thematic stuff, curiosity, creativity. Some days I can't do it because I'll be so depressed I can't get out of bed. But if I'm on a sort of not terrible depression, but I'm declining, I go through every single one of them every day and I just try and tick them off. Listen to music, not the news. Read books, not newspapers. Think of somebody you've not spoken to in a while. Reach out to them. Tell them what's going on. Be open, be honest. And, you know, it could be coincidence, but my depression's been a lot better since I got my jam jar.
Since the jam jar.
Yeah.
I'm Mark Scott, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Sydney. Alistair Campbell is a journalist, author, broadcaster, and mental health campaigner. And his podcast is called The Rest is Politics.
I've got to be honest, it's been a bit of a surprise that it's been quite as popular as it is. So, you know, I've been around a long time. I mean, I left government more than 20 years ago. So I've been kind of on this, doing talking, writing, broadcasting ever since. But this has cut through in a way that very little I've ever done before has.
And in Australia, you can call Beyond Blue on 1300 224636 for free mental health advice and support. That's 1300 224636. Please take care of yourself. As Alistair reflected, nations are becoming increasingly polarised. So how do we come together to create big and lasting change?
What I saw in early days for me in politics was this ability of someone like Julie Gillard as Prime Minister after having worked across some 17 days to bring people together and form government, have a deep interest in what motivates people and a willingness to actually get in the room and negotiate. And I think that that's foundational to actually being able to bring people together, a sense of what is it defines them, what's distinctive, and how might you find common ground between them.
Scroll back in your podcast feed to find that episode of The Solutionists with Kate Harrison-Brennan from the Sydney Policy Lab. The Solutionists is a podcast from the University of Sydney produced by Dead Set Studios. This episode was recorded at the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences Media Room, and our thanks to the technical staff here.